This is the Empower Podcast, released June 2nd, 2019. Episode 445, Ludicrously High Frequency Interference.
Welcome to the Amp Hour. I'm Dave Jones from the EEV blog.
And I'm Chris Campbell of Contextual Electronics.
We're back.
Yeah, and it's real early morning there for you.
I'm not awake.
This is the old days of like you waking up and going to the garage before work and like.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, yeah.
If I'm more coherent, and if I'm less coherent than I normally am, then which is hard, then you know what?
You have at least an excuse. Well, that's good, man. Excellent. What have you been up to?
I've been doing the same old shit.
All right.
Yeah. No, sorry for adding in the swear word. See, that's a swear word in America, isn't it? That'd get us like PG-13 rating or something.
We're already listed as explicit on iTunes and everything.
Oh,
so.
Are we?
Yeah.
Okay. I take no chances. Me.
No, not just you. I've been slipping.
You've dropped the occasional bomb, huh?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
So, you know, I slip from time to time. And
right.
Better safe than sorry, you know. If you're listening in a car with children right now, you may want to cover their ears, or they're probably asleep anyways if they're listening to electronics podcasts, you know.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, it's always a, like, you know, I've had that a few times, not a lot, but, you know, a handful of times over the years, I've gotten emails or whatever saying, oh, you need to be kid friendly and you need to stop doing this and that. And, you know, I'm going, oh, geez, you know, there's like... If you want that, I'm sure there's tons of content already out there. Yeah, but we want your content to be. You know, they're sort of like demanding. And I actually got that the other day because Sagan's thought about that the other day. Because Sagan watches a Curious Droid on his YouTube channel. He does like space stuff. Really, really cool. And he wears like big colorful shirt, different shirts in every episode. It's fantastic. It's really well produced material. He loves that. And, I'm thinking, you know, like 7-year-olds are watching that, you know, you wouldn't think that 7-year-olds would be watching that sort of content.
Oh, no, kids watch YouTube all the time.
And it's certainly not aimed at kids, you know, it's aimed at, you know, it's pretty advanced stuff he's talking about.
Yeah, it makes you wonder if, like, that, you know, if that's going to be, if they, like, kind of, like, pick stuff up by osmosis or just, you know, from just general learning, I guess, you know, it's pretty cool.
Right.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah. I mean, you could be like subliminally teaching kids electronics if you'd clean up your act, Dave.
Right. But even if I did, even if I went totally kid friendly, like it's not like the kids are going to suddenly flock in.
No.
You know, it's like, yeah. So we're only talking, it's not, kids aren't not watching me because of that.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, yeah.
Yep.
And most parents aren't going to be monitoring their kids' YouTubing anyway. So.
Oh, I don't know about that, but I don't have
kids.
Yeah,
but once they reach a certain age, like if they age, you know, I can understand, you know, 7 and 8, but once they hit, you know, pre-teens and
13,
you know,
or whatever
teens,
the age is.
No, the kids aren't, the parents aren't going to bother anymore.
Yeah,
it's like,
well,
meh, whatever.
Well, you would get beeped out around here, I think, you know, and that's the FCC. I think it's FCC, right?
I think it's FCC.
I mostly want to just talk about the FCC.
But do they regulate? You're right. I thought they only regulated the spectrum. Not the material on the spectrum.
I thought it was them too. Like who beeps this?
Right. Who's the sensor?
Yeah.
Right.
I thought it was the FCC. But anyways, I've been talking to the FCC. Well, not FCC specifically, but I had a chance to sit down with a testing house here in Chicago.
Awesome.
Yeah, it was great. Basically, They came in. I didn't know this test house was coming in, but I basically
coming into where?
Oh,
into
my workspace.
The
sorry,
hub, the,
yeah,
yeah,
M-Hub.
M-Hub.
And, and so this guy just showed up. You know, they were doing like a lunch and learn type thing. I bent that guy's ear for like 2 hours, and he was awesome. You know, like when you get like a hold.
And then
of,
he came
like,
out going, "Oh, he's not going to be a paying customer."
No, I probably will. But like, you know, like when you had like that Nobel Prize guy on, right?
It's
you just like want to keep asking him questions, anyways.
Yeah, of course, I know. You just keep chatting.
Yeah, exactly. But what I found out is that there's a new guidance that's out there. Now this is like.
guideline.
Yeah, this is like
this is official. It's come down.
This
from
is an
Sam.
Official thing from FCC. Right. Basically, like it's a checklist for getting approved, like for getting stuff approved, and it's really dry wording. But basically, it's like as people are taking stuff towards Part 15A, Part 15B, intentional, non-intentional. It's like guidelines on what you should be doing for doing that kind of thing. So I said I'd mention it on here because like that. First off, they hadn't had that previously. It was basically like a knowledge-based article they had, but now there's actually something out there that's officially like, "Hey, here's the things
they can
you should
point
be doing."
To. Yeah,
exactly. So, so I'll link that stuff.
But you should be doing to what pass or to be a good little boy, you know.
I think
I guess
it's more
there's
like
no difference. As long as you pass, you pass, right?
Yeah, I think it's more like right. that. It's definitely like. Dry language. Let's see. What is the question? What is the FCC guidance for equipment authorization of transmitter module devices and equipment that incorporates transmitter modules? Yeah, exactly. That's not just early morning. That's and like this whole site. Yeah. I mean, like the whole FCC site is
of course
is
it
like
is.
That. But oh man. Well, and that's another thing that was interesting though. He said, you know, if you go to the EU, if you go to the EU website, it's actually better wording. But if you pass EU, you'll probably also pass. FCC.
Of course. Yeah. That's so, I think that's a given. Yeah.
I didn't know. So like I'm new to a lot of this stuff. So really interesting stuff. I'll put some links in the show notes about this and what some of what he was going through. You know, I was just talking about using like two unlicensed bands, you know, pretty common ones, 900, 2.4, and like he was telling me what to look through as well and you know, things you need to look at. So it's a yeah, it's interesting. It's an interesting new thing. Intentional
Sweet.
Transmitting. Yeah. So. Yeah.
Got it. But I thought they already would have had guide like they well they have their
well,
standards.
They write
you're,
regulations
you're sort of different
right.
between right.
Yeah, they write regulations. This is more like guidelines, right? So.
Right. Okay. They're
like
trying to be a bit more approachable, are they?
I think so, I think it's like the difference between like a legal document and like. A guideline or like a guideline, that's exactly what it is. It's the difference between like a legal document and like a blog post about a legal issue. You know, it's kind of like the equivalent sort of. I don't know if it's quite as friendly as a blog post, but that's kind of the idea. So
I've got a segue with this.
Yeah, go for it.
Something that apparently if you launch a satellite from US soil, you have to meet FCC requirements or who I think FCC govern the space as well.
Oh, really? Okay, so like the...
I think so. I think that's how it is. But there's a thing which just it exploded on the internet last week in that, you know, how SpaceX, Elon Musk, has been sending up all these Starlink satellites, sent up the first 60. Did you hear about this?
Those things
Starlink?
Are amazing. Yeah.
And they plan to launch like up to like several thousand of these initially and then up to 10,000 plus. Mm-hmm. And 10 or 11,000 of these satellites in low
space
in various radii. Yeah. And if you don't know, there's only a couple of, there's only like 2,000 active satellites in the whole sphere up there now. Mm-hmm. And if you include like junk, you know, space junk and stuff, there's only like 3,000 or something, you know, like low numbers. They plan on like quadrupling the number of stuff
up
there.
Yeah, it's about
to
get much more crowded. Yep.
Yeah, and then there's all these other companies. Amazon are doing it as well. And there's, two other competing ones to start with.
Oh, yeah, well, so
we're
we
all
have...
trying to get these internet satellites up there.
Right, and I think there's like high bandwidth, like Starlink is like high bandwidth stuff. It's meant to be like a actual like a cable internet provider style.
Yes, and it's phased array, so it can handle like thousands of connections at once. You know, each satellite can handle, you know, 10,000 people or something's internet and huge bandwidth stuff because they're so close that And anyway, the problem is that nobody really saw coming. No pun intended. Is that you can see the damn things.
Yeah, right.
And
right.
This is like apparently they're really bright for a couple of hours after dusk and before Dawn, and this is like, this sky is going to be filled with these. These are geosynchronous, so they don't just sit in the
right,
one
they're
spot.
Gonna be moving around.
They're just whizzing over. Yep. That's right. And apparently they're always doing little course corrections and stuff, so they're very difficult, almost impossible to track accurately, so that the astronomers can actually know the locations of them. And apparently it's going to destroy astronomy, or it's going to make it, you know, order of magnitude harder. And it's going to ruin not only astronomy, but like the sky at night for people who just love to stargaze.
You know, they'll look like stars. They'll look like shooting stars, pretty much, right?
Little shooting, like whizzing stars everywhere. Yeah. And like, I know it's a, like, people, it's a kind of an exciting thing to, you know, sit out there at night and go, oh, there's a satellite. You know, like if you sit there long enough and stare at the sky, you'll catch a glimpse of a satellite going over. But imagine that multiplied by 100.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like it's going to become too much. And there's a lot of people out there saying, why didn't anyone think of this? And and Elon Musk is coming out saying, oh, no, they won't be visible. They're too small and blah, blah, blah. And people are taking cell phone videos.
Yeah, I've seen like the, because it was especially like the string of them as they, because they started the as one as, bundle as and then they started them. Going out, right?
Then they deploy them, and then they've got little it's a whiz bang new thruster system too.
Is argon?
Is it argon gas or something? It's one of those.
No, Krypton. It was Krypton.
Krypton. Yes, that's it. Krypton.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
And little Krypton thrusters that move them around. And because their position is not critical, unlike GPS, for example, they can like course correct all the time, and they don't really have to tell anyone. Mm. You know, like it just doesn't matter as long as they sort of keep a rough equidistant between them.
Should we do like a countdown before like satellite collisions are happening? I mean,
I don't think that's ever going to happen. There's just space is a big ass bit of territory up there. Space is big. Yeah. Yeah. So, people think, putting 10,000 up there, we won't be able to get through. You know, rockets will just be blowing up as they go up. No, the odds are, it decreases from, or it increases from like 0.01% of a collision to 0.1% or something. You know, it's not even. Like, you know, it barely raises the actual percentage of hitting something as you launch a rocket. But still, you know, it's a... Because they're only one object, unlike what... was it India? Who exploded that satellite? Who shot down one of their own satellites to test their new weapon system? And the debris just boom into 10,000 little pieces.
Oh, yeah.
Last month. I think it was India or something. Yeah, India wanted to show their, you know, their might and... shot down a satellite. So, oops. And now it's just created junk everywhere. Anyway.
So you were mentioning the FCC was covering stuff on U.S. soil. Does that mean that all those will be also?
They are. I believe, yes, they have to meet certification because they were launched from the U.S. Or any, even maybe if you're a U.S. company and you launch overseas, I think you still have to...
Yeah.
Meet their requirements or whatever. So anyway, but nobody thought of what I'm trying to get to here after all this is that nobody thought about the visual problem.
The visual, right.
You know, which is like interference.
Sure.
The same
as
EMC as interference, right?
Did you see my tweet about that? I've been reading this RF book, and there's different, like, you know, there's like high frequency, ultra high frequency, whatever.
Oh, yes.
300 gigahertz and above is ludicrously high frequency. People kept saying, like, yeah, that's light. That's light is ludicrously high frequency. So it's ludicrously high frequency interference.
I had never heard that before.
I had not either.
Is that an official band, or is that?
Oh, yeah. That's from, remember where it's from. I mean, so the book is Planar Microwave Engineering. It is a fantastic book, by the way. Really have been enjoying it.
I'm sure it's riveting. Sure, it's
It's actually really funny written. It's really good writing.
Right.
Yeah, I'm hoping to get the author on the show later this year. So cool. We'll see. Yeah. One more thing I wanted to mention about the FCC, though. I was really surprised from this guy told me. Did you know that both? So we had made the jokes on here about like the white label goods. Remember how we had talked about that? Like how ovens aren't regulated.
No, come on. You know I don't remember. You know we've done like 500 shows and I don't remember shit.
Yeah, right. So we had talked on here briefly, I think, and I think I mentioned on one of the guest shows as well, is that...
I remember that was in 2012.
This was like a month ago, Dave. Come on.
Oh, was it? Okay, yeah. Right. Oh, come on.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, so there was basically white label goods like ovens and dishwashers aren't covered. Yep. You don't have to have compliance on those.
Oh, but, that's right. Yeah, now it rings
a bell. All right. So good.
Yeah, which is very surprising.
So this guy, Steve...
Does that include microwave ovens?
It does not. Yeah, that one actually...
Right, okay.
Yeah, it's
right,
certain white label goods. Yeah.
Right, okay.
However, did you know that cars are not regulated?
What?
Yeah, I had the exact same reaction. And what? Again, this is from this guy, Steve, who I met. And so I'm going completely off his word. I have not verified it in a sense. But he said that because cars are going to interact so much with consumer goods that they leave it up to the car manufacturers and they self-regulate. So they still do testing, but they're not required.
Yeah, because I see it all the time. Like these test chambers, EMC test chambers, they've got ones where you can drive a car and a truck in, and they put the car on the big turntable and they EMC test it.
Yeah.
Like you see it all the time. I thought it was a given that
I think it's just like
automotive EMC testing. It's compliance. There's compliance standards they're testing to. CISPA 25. Compliant.
I think that.
Anechoic RF chamber.
CISPA 25 might be their thing, but at least that's what he was telling me, is that cars are self-regulated, that is part of their industry, not covered by the FCC.
Wow. Okay. Right. That's interesting.
Which was like, so like, of course you still like, and so like, and we were talking about a bunch of testing things as well. And I'd like to get someone like this, Steve on the show as well. Just like someone like to kind of talk about all the realities of the testing industry. Cause I think it's a little snoozy, but I love it. Like I was really fascinated, and I think it has huge implications for, you know, the stuff we're doing. Just getting a little bit of truth around that, right? But he was talking too, like someone else came up and was asking about like UL testing and stuff like that. And same thing, like UL testing is not required by anyone. But what it is required by is like, if you want to sell your stuff in like Walmart, Walmart's going to say, yeah, you better have a UL rating. Or Home Depot is going to say, yeah, you better have a UL rating. And at that point, it's like an ad hoc rating. You know, it's like you better have it or else.
You're right. I'm looking at the list now. Every manufacturer has their own standard. Like General Motors, GMW 3097, Ford has their own standard, Toyota, Mitsubishi, Renault. I am seeing SAE standard, a J113 standard, but I think that's just for the connector. I think that's just for like the DIN connector interface and stuff. I don't think that's EMC. And there's CISPA 12, 13, 25. But yeah, you're right. They have their own. They have their own standards. Wow. Yeah. You learn something new every day on the Amp Hour.
That's right. Even during the Amp Hour sometimes. You have to send me that list too. That's a good, that sounds good. We'll add to the notes too.
Interesting.
But yeah, I mean like this kind of stuff, it's like, it feels like so much of the stuff that I was talking to him about was just like, you know, I have like these assumptions about what you do and don't need to do, but you know, it's, at the end of the day, it comes down to like, there's regulation, of course, and like even regulation, this is going to sound really bad, it's only regulation if you get caught doing this thing. Now, if you get big enough, you're going to get caught. Right?
Got.
But for a lot of the stuff, it's like, you know, people are doing this in good faith because they are hopeful that they're going to get big enough. And if they don't do this stuff, then if they don't do the testing, they're going to get screwed. You know? It's like, all your stuff gets pulled from the shelf, you get fined and yada, yada, yada. But, you know, just kind of the absolute minimums of the things you need to do and the things you should be doing, those are always really interesting to me because what are those things, you know?
Well, I, of course, come from the ultimate free-for-all market. The marine market, the oceanic market, the marine environment. There are, once you leave international waters, there are no regulations. I never had
the
to
only
design
rule is
to
there
EMC
are no rules.
And yeah, so all the military, all the marine underwater military stuff I worked on, all the civil stuff I worked on for the underwater seismic stuff and boat-based stuff as well, equipment goes on. None of that had to meet any standards at all.
Really?
Okay. It was like, yeah, and the industry didn't really even have its own, any of its own standards. There weren't any in-house standards as well. It's like, does it do the job? Yep, that's it. You know, it's like, screw anything
spewing RF like it's its job, yeah.
Yep, that's it. Mm. So, yeah, you just didn't care.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that's, I mean, I think that's, as we talk to people that are doing like consumer goods, of course, this is like number one kind of thing.
Heavily regulated. Yeah.
Right. And it makes sense too, from a volume perspective, like what you're talking about. Sometimes you were working on things that were really expensive, but you'd have like 10 of them in the world, right?
You'd have 10 of them. Yeah.
Right. Versus something where it's a cheapo thing that's going to be like 10 million of them in a month. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. A little more impact there. That's interesting.
Got it.
There was no regulation on anything or what?
No. Okay. I don't ever recall a regulation on anything at all.
Yeah. I guess you would be self-testing though too. I guess that's what I think. That's the difference. Is like testing about testing versus regulation.
You would make up your own
testing
requirements. I'd be writing the testing documents myself.
Yeah.
Coming up with the standards.
Right. Well, and there's like mil spec stuff too, that is used as like a guideline.
There's mil spec stuff course. And if you're interfacing with stuff, then of course you have to meet the interface specifications of that thing. But apart from that, EMC just geez.
Yeah.
Nobody ever worried about that.
Mm, yeah. Yep. Well, and I think, too, these days, like, as so many more things have radios on them, you know, it's just such an important concern these days because, like, everything spews 2.4 gigahertz. Everything spews 900 megahertz or whatever your local thing is. Mm-hmm. And it's, like, that's when it's really going to start to, you know, people get mad about Wi-Fi. And if your thing is messing up their Wi-Fi, they're going to get pissed.
Yep.
So, yeah.
The only time I had to meet any standards was doing some RF test gear for use in the production facility.
Oh, okay.
And stuff like that. You know, you've got to get certified modules, your things like that. But, apart from that, not in the actual products.
Right.
Hmm.
Huh. Cool. Well, we'll get some more people on here to talk about that for sure because... I was like thinking about asking Steve this guy to be on. I was like, I could probably ask him a bunch of free questions about stuff if I just have him on the amp hour. And everybody else gets to hear it too. It's great.
Free consulting.
Yeah. My secret's out now.
Yeah.
Been doing that for 9 years now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now we have to talk about the Huawei thing. Am I pronouncing it correctly?
That's how I say it. I say Huawei. Yeah. Yeah.
Huawei.
I usually don't say the H usually. I don't know if that's correct or not. Yeah.
Huawei.
Like, yeah.
Huawei.
Yeah.
That's like a very Aussie thing to do, is to drop.
Or British thing too, yeah.
British, yeah.
You know, Aussies are just diet British people, right?
Right. Yeah, right. Okay. Yeah.
British people left in the sun for too long.
Yeah, that's it.
Little sun-addled brains.
Oh goodness. Yeah, anyways. This is big because I bloody went and bought a new Huawei Mate phone.
I know,
which is
like
really great,
good,
by the way.
Nice spec'd phones. Like the cameras are amazing.
Really, they're really great. They're still shit in low light. Like everyone goes, the most amazing cameras ever. Yeah, put them in freaking, go down to my dumpster room and try and take a video. It looks like shit.
Right.
Okay.
Why didn't they call you about that, Dave?
Well, the thing is, it looks fantastic on the screen. Right.
Oh,
when I was down there, right, because my old phone, which was a bloody, what was it? Motorola X-Force, right? And it just shot horrible video down there. And it looked horrible on the screen. You could see it. But the Huawei one looked fantastic on the screen. So I thought, when I first shot video down there, I'm going, this is amazing footage.
Mm-hmm.
It looked great on the screen. Then I got it back and blew it up on the editing, full screen editing going. And I'm going, look at all the processing they're doing on that smoothing out things.
Yeah, exactly. Yep.
Oh, it's like, you're going to be shitting me. This is terrible. You know, so it's still crap.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
So, yep.
Well, anyway. If you just, replace your... computer monitor with a Huawei as well, then you'd be in good shape.
Right, with a tiny little shrink it down,
that's
get
right,
a little,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
6-inch preview screen and everything will look fantastic. Unbelievable. Anyway, yes, they are very good if you give them enough light, but anyway. So I went and bought one and then like 3 days later, of course, the big announcement came that Uncle Sam would, was banned him. And then Google, of course, being a US company, had to comply. And then they announced that they were going to stop in 90 days, they were going to stop supporting Huawei products. And of course, if your phone doesn't support Google, that includes the Google Play Store. Yeah, so you won't even be able to install bloody Android apps, you know? Yeah. So
right, and Apple, it doesn't matter for Apple because you're not going to have, they don't support it with iOS. So then it's basically like, okay, so now what? Are they just going to spin up a OS from scratch? It's like, oh, maybe not.
Right. Well, no, because Android's open source, right?
Right.
They can technically take it and spin their own version.
Right.
They can do that.
Sure.
There's nothing legally stopping them. But if you can't, if consumers can't access the Android App Store, then, well, they have to make their own app store, and then people will have to put their Android apps on the Huawei store specifically. So now you'd have to, you know, all those millions of apps out there would have to be on, you know, people that have to manually upload to these different platform as well.
I wouldn't actually put it out of the realm of possibility that that happens and it takes off potentially. People love cheap hardware and like good hardware too, to be honest. Yep. So I wouldn't
It's not cheap hardware. These phones aren't
cheap.
That's
true. Sure, sure. But yeah, they also make cheap hardware. They don't just make really high-end stuff.
I haven't looked at their, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting how this is. I mean, so we should say, obviously, this is a protracted U.S. thing. I personally, I'm pissed off about it all. I think it's a...
It's ridiculous. In this era of global trade, it's just,
Just the protectionism is very frustrating. You know, people can have their politics, that's fine, whatever. But I'm personally very frustrated. And, you know, there's more tariffs that came through. I'm paying tariffs crazy.
I don't mind the idea of tariffs and actually protecting your country and stuff like that. If you want to do that, well, okay, you live and die in the on the marketplace, right? Kind of thing. But to outright ban, you know, like this is just ridiculous.
Well, and I do agree with the tariff stuff. I don't agree with. I do think there's some IP abuses in general, and I don't know how to deal with them other than that. I think that it's a little commingled in there, so I don't really know how to deal with that stuff. I will give that some credit, but at the end of the day, it's just interesting to see how this has rippled through the industry as well, right? There was also
an
article about how internally at ARM now as well. So ARM is not a U.S. company; it's a British company, right? They're based out of Cambridge in the UK.
Yeah,
and I already lost the article. Where'd it go? It was basically like the here it is. There was an internal memo that said, stop working with Huawei at ARM.
And that is pure politics. That's come through. Somebody knows somebody. Somebody's tapped somebody on the shoulder at 10 Downing Street. And then 10 Downing Street has tapped somebody on the shoulder at ARM.
Oh, maybe. And, I don't even know if it's about that. It could just be a pure profit thing, though, too. I mean, if it's a...
No. Yeah. No, of course they're going to want to sell. If it's pure profit, they're not going to want to ditch one of the hugest companies on the planet, Huawei. I mean, they're enormous. They're like just, I think they're just about to overtake Apple. They were like, you know, months away from overtaking Apple in terms of like market, wealth kind of, you know, market.
Yeah, like valuation.
Capitalization. Yeah, so like they are enormous. Mm. So if it's purely profit motive, no way. I ain't buying that for a second.
Just meant like it could be. Yeah, it could be from other side of things. But yeah, you're right. Yeah, I guess you're right that they would probably just want to sell as many chips as they could. So it'll be interesting to see what happens from that and if
For those who don't know, ARM don't sell chips.
That's right.
They sell licenses
IP.
To cores.
Yeah.
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 Sell IP. Yeah.
Yeah, and so people on the various forums were talking about like, oh, RISC-V now is going to become huge from this. Like, I don't think that's going to be the ultimate result of this, but it is an interesting, you know, mind game at least of like, oh,
yeah,
maybe there is another way, you know. But we'll see what happens with that.
What is the competition to ARM? I mean, RISC-V is technically competition, right? But it's so new and small in the scheme of things,
right?
That, you know, it's much more niche and academic than it is practical, I guess.
I think the other thing
what
would
other
be like
competition is there?
Intel Mobile, but like, yeah, I don't think that actually is a real thing.
Right. Yep.
Yeah.
So anyway, it's fascinating, and how Huawei have been buying up stock in anticipation of this happening. So they were buying up stock, like billions of dollars in stock, as in component supply stock.
So
so they can keep going for a while. They can keep manufacturing phones, but of course you can cut them off at the software front.
Right.
So
right.
Yeah, and it all has to do with Google, googly.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think like what you said earlier is like it keeps highlighting like how completely interconnected the ecosystem is, and like any small wrench in the works, really just the whole machine comes tumbling apart. I think that's why I'm concerned in general. Like obviously I buy out of distribution. I'm of the smallest of the small players. It's not like I have any stake in this, right? Like you said, you know, I pay the tariffs. That's fine. I have to do it. Like, I'm just going to do it.
But it hasn't been a showstopper for anyone. Yeah, like, people are annoyed by the tariffs.
Right, but I think that, like...
But it hasn't stopped you getting parts, and that...
That's correct. So, that's correct. But I think that, like, the brinksmanship type actions from all this, I think that could lead to greater actions, greater, you know, shutdown of factories, stuff like that. I think... Like, mostly I'm just nervous about it. Like, you're right. There's nothing in the short term that affects me. I'm not Huawei.
right.
It's surprising, but it's true. But I think that I'm just, you know, keep an eye on things.
And it is, you've got to, you know, cue the conspiracy theorist, but it's very interesting timing for this. I mean, Huawei were virtually unknown a year ago, right? Nobody was buying Huawei phones, right?
I was. I had a Nexus 6P that was by Huawei, yeah. That was a Google phone. Okay. They were making Google phones.
Oh, they were making Google. That was the Google phone, was it?
Mm-hmm. The Nexus 6P was. They bounced between different manufacturers. You know, Nexus 5, right. Nexus 4, Nexus whatever. They were all different.
Yeah, but you were buying a Google branded phone, like Huawei. Like, it's not like you were going bragging to people, "Hey, look, I've got a Huawei."
That's right? True. I bought it because it was a Nexus 6P. That's right.
Yeah, exactly. So they were just like this mysterious OEM who manufactured these phones in China, right?
Yep.
And, you know, as huge as they were, they weren't well known. But now their brand has just like in the last year.
I think that's the big thing.
No, of course.
Yeah.
And last year and a half, they've been gotten huge. And, of course, they're threatening to overtake Apple and become like the biggest player on the market. All of a sudden, well, let's stop them, basically. So I'm not sure of the original trigger or what is. And do you know what the original trigger for all this is?
The two things that I read about was that
they arrested one of the Huawei executives. They arrested one of them, the US authorities.
Yes, that's right. The CTO was arrested in Toronto.
Yep.
And then sent to the US.
I
don't remember on that one.
This is our new politics segment of the NPR.
The two things that I kept hearing about were, one, the concerns about 5G equipment on the back end, and then having basically backdoors into that. That was one concern.
Oh, okay.
That I heard about again.
Oh yes, because they were selling chipsets or something, weren't they? They were selling router products and stuff.
And then the other thing was just general like IP, playing fast and loose with IP, and then having no recourse against it. So those are the two things I heard. Right. I'm not sure how accurate those are. I'm sure people will let us know in the comments. They're so good about popping out of the woodwork when there's politics stuff. But I think there's a lot of like geopolitical stuff that's tied up in this as well. So
way above our pay grade, Chris.
Way above. I mean, at the end of the day, you just want a phone that works, and now you've got a borked phone.
Literally like 3 or 4 days after I bought it.
Yeah, it sucks. Like,
yeah, anyway, luckily I didn't buy the high-end one, see, because I never buy the leading-edge phone. I always buy like a gen behind at least.
Yeah.
Because they're cheaper and they're almost as good as the, you know, the latest one.
Nobody has ever accused us of being bleeding edge, Dave.
Right, okay. True.
Yeah.
There goes our plans to rename the show to the Bleeding Edge Podcast.
Oh, we were going to do that's right. We were going to do Bleeding Edge. We were going to do a crypto coin. That's what I sent you that email about.
Oh, yes, a crypto coin. Yes, I've been thinking about doing my own crypto coin.
Oh, boy.
As well as my own real coin. I've always, like, I think I want to put my head on, like, a real minted coin. So I want to mint my own coin. So seriously, I'm dead serious. Has any contacts or any skill in actually designing punched dies?
Oh, I was going to say you should just
or the artwork for the coins that you can send to the punched die makers. Please get in contact.
Well, you should look at those. You know, challenge coins are like a big thing now. Do you know what challenge coins are?
Yeah, they are. Okay. Yep.
And like, there's like services now. You can do those on demand.
Yeah, but they're more medallion-like. Like, want a crafted... Like, there's two ways to do these type of coins. There's the, you know, there's the cheap way, like the challenge coins are done, and then there's the old-school professional way, which is to get some, you know, greybeard nude virgin to sit there carving out the queen's head on the stamping die, you know, on the stainless, like on the steel stamping die, and then actually stamp them out, the high relief coins, as they're called.
Got it.
And there's various finishes on coins and stuff like that. And
I knew it. None of these things. Yeah.
No, well, you know. So yeah, if anyone has the skills to do that, I'm actually dead serious about getting my own, pure silver coin minted. So yep. Please contact me, davidevblog.com.
Okay.
there might be something in it for you.
Right, he'll pay you in coins as soon as he makes them.
I'll pay you in coins, yeah. I'll pay you in silver.
Yeah.
We should be doing our own crypto coin. So you reckon it's too simple these days, do you?
I had sent Dave an email. Like,
well, a coin or a token?
Yeah.
Token, Chris. No, it's a big decision.
I don't want to do any of this stuff, Dave. I was just joking about it. That was just a Bleeding Edge joke. That's all that was.
Because you know that I'm into crypto.
Yes,
so.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yep.
Cryptocurrency, not
I do accept crypto on my store, and I give a discount on evblog.com/store.
Right.
Over and above my usual sale discounts, if you're paying crypto... Actually get like 10% off.
Selling.
I will happily shill the merch. So I will happily take your crypto. Mm. Thank you. You can use it to buy something really tangible.
That's right. Yeah, so, especially as you. I guess you've been moving through revisions on stuff too, right? You said why did you put something on sale or no?
My meter's on sale, my 121 GW meter. I'm just trying to clear out stock. So I got cash for a new big shipment.
Yeah, got it. Yep. Cool.
Yep.
Cool.
It's all a cash flow thing. You know, we talked about that on a
previous... Yeah, we did talk about that previously. Yep.
Yeah, like 6 months ago when I ran out of... The business ran out of cash. Oops. Yep.
He's still here, though. He's still here.
I'm still here. Yeah. I'm not destitute. I'm not will podcast for food. You know, I'm not sitting there with the brown paper sign, cardboard sign.
That's right. That's right.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway,
I've actually been doing some CM stuff
contract manufacturing.
Thank you. That's some big cash outlays as well. But it's been
on your part. Why? Because you've got to build the stuff.
No. Sorry, it's not my dollars. It's just going and seeing the dollars slide by, and I pay the.
Oh, you pass it on. So they pay you.
That's right.
They pay you $1 million, and then you realize you have to pay $950,000 to. Yep.
Yeah. Right.
It's the old Kickstarter thing. You know, you do your Kickstarter, and $500,000 suddenly appears in your bank account, and you feel rich, and then you realize, well, I've got to spend almost that amount on actually buying stuff.
$490,000.
Yeah, that's
$1,000. Yeah.
So if people want to know how much I made off my 121 GW Kickstarter, don't ask. It's a bit depressing.
Hey, if you made any dollars, you're in good shape, actually.
Exactly. Yeah. If you came out ahead. That's right. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's been interesting.
I was still paying bills like 9 months later after that.
I believe it. Yeah.
Like, you know, stuff I'd forgotten about. And then all of a sudden I'd get an invoice from a Like, unbelievable.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, cash flow is a real business thing, man. Especially in hardware. Yeah.
And if you don't keep track of it, you can come a gutsa.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, you think you have. I mean, like, that's why it's always dangerous to look at the bank account balance, I think, versus like what's in your accounting system.
Because I thought it was done and dusted. Like, oh, it's been 6 months, 9 months, or whatever. I thought, oh yeah, I've paid for everything. Then all of a sudden, a supplier comes to you and said, hey, you haven't paid for those thing, or you haven't paid for the shipping. Just like 3 months ago. How long was the Kickstarter ago? A year and a half ago? It was only like, it wasn't that long. Maybe 3-4 months ago, I got maybe 4-5 months ago, I got an email from the manufacturer saying, hey, you haven't paid the shipping invoice. It's like, $12,000.
Oh my.
It's like, we shipped all these things to Europe for you. You didn't pay that.
Wow.
It's like, holy crap. Yeah, that's a lot of money. And that's US dollars.
Yeah.
So that translates to like 18 grand Australian or something.
Right, right.
That's a crap ton
Aussie
of money.
Aussie buckaroos, is that what they call them?
Yeah. Aussie dollaradoos.
Dollaradoos, that's right. Yeah, I saw that on Twitter.
Dollaradoos. Yeah, dollaradoos. And that's from a Simpsons episode, isn't it, I think?
Probably right, yeah.
Yeah, anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that just comes out of the blue, and then you have to try and go through your records to see if you've paid this, and it's like, and you're just going through, and looks like I haven't, but I'm not 100% sure, and because money was just flowing willy nilly everywhere.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, during that, and it was just impossible to keep track of. This is why you need, you know, we talked about the ERP systems and stuff like that to keep track of these sorts of things.
Dave, I have a book recommendation. If you'd like one.
Yeah, of course. You know I always like your book recommendations.
I know. This one's called Financial Intelligence for Entrepreneurs. You might like that one.
Right, yeah.
I've just started. I'm about 10% in. It's pretty good so far, though. It's like approachable for what it is, you know. Basically being able to...
Do you ever implement anything in these books that you read? These all the time. Of self-help books that you read?
This one's less... This is actually more practical than self-helpy. I can tell... Right. I just read How to Fail at Everything. And still win big. That's very self-helpy, right. And I actually didn't like that. That's the Scott Adams book.
Right. Okay. As in Dilbert.
Dilbert, yeah. Yeah, he wrote like a self-help book, effectively. Not very...
Oh, yeah, yeah. Good. If you actually follow his blog, he's, you know, big on that sort of stuff.
Yeah, it was reading like a condensed version of his blog. No, this is more about actual, like, doing finance for small businesses. So that was more...
Right.
In that vein, I'm sure
everyone's rushing out to get that one.
Hey, whatever, man. These are There might be someone who likes
it. It's good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Of course. Yeah. Of course. No, this stuff can be important. You know, it's just like it's not sexy.
Right.
You know,
definitely
no one wants to. You know, no one goes, oh, I'm going to learn all about finance and
right.
Like, oh god.
It's a Friday night. Yeah. I'm going to grab a bottle of wine and a cash flow statement and see what happens.
Yeah, that's it. And I'm going to finish off my TPS reports.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
For those who don't know, Google TPS reports and watch the movie.
Yeah, that's right.
It's hilarious.
Well, I mean, so I'm actually in the middle of like doing reporting stuff though too. Like, so this is kind of what I wanted to talk about, like CMs and standardization and stuff like this. I wanted to ask your opinion on doing assemblies. Ooh. Right? So
yes.
When you start stacking up different, you know, like, so you have a BOM for your board. But your board is probably getting integrated into plastics that also has, you know, maybe some glue and some screws and some, you know, labeling and everything like that. And there's like going to be a top level BOM that is actually for your entire product. So like, let's just use the 121 GW meter as an example, right?
Yep.
That top level, the 121 GW top level assembly has a case, the tilting bale, the PCBs internally, the battery slots,
the rubber surround, the buttons, exactly. The button moldings, the screen protective acrylic thing, even the peel off thing which goes on the screen, you know, that peel off.
Oh yeah, 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 the protector, yeah.
You know, everything. Yeah,
that costs money, right?
It's another BOM item, yeah.
Right. So, okay, so now this isn't a great example because I don't think you assign part numbers for everything, but say you were doing...
Well, I am not that deeply involved the 121 manufacturing that.
Right, right, right. So you've never seen the actual BOM. Right, you spec'd it out, but you didn't actually do that thing. So now, like, let's go sideways to maybe just a product you're making or I'm making.
Which is the micro supplier just sent you a photo.
Oh, yeah.
Of the,
yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So And that's
we can talk about this because we're actually getting four assembled at the moment.
Perfect example. Yeah. And we're allowed to share this picture or no?
No, okay. I've shared it to the supporters on the forum.
All right, so people
haven't shared it publicly.
People know that there's a keypad because you've talked about that. There's an LCD. There's probably plugs, whatever. And there's a case, right?
There's custom banana plugs. There's like seven different custom parts on this thing.
Okay, so you've got custom parts now. How do you create a name for that, for each part?
We don't, essentially. The manufacturer usually does that. Manufacturer will give it an internal part number, and then we just use that. We just take that internal part number that the manufacturer supplies. It'll be, Jones-20 or something.
Right,
exactly.
And we
just,
Right. So then, you are making the circuit board assembly that's in there, or multiple assemblies, right?
Yes.
So what do you call that?
Oh, we wouldn't go to that detail because we're not that advanced. We'd just call it the assembled PCB. It wouldn't have a part number. Like some people, and this is the thing, companies I've worked at, you will put the assembled part number onto the silk screen of the board.
That's right. Yeah.
So there'll be two part numbers on the board. There'll be a part number for the bare PCB, and then there'll be a part number for the assembled PCB. And that's actually done at the design stage and put onto the PCB. We would have systems internal to the company where you generate a new part number.
Right. That's done in product lifecycle maintenance. Software like PLM,
Arena
system,
Matrix. Yeah, and if you're a huge enough company, you'll have 364 at the start, and then that designates that product, and then you'll have a four-digit number after that.
That's right. Yep.
Right.
So I've been looking through all this, and it's super yawn, but it's like, but this can really ripple through your design. You think about it, so I've been thinking forward.
Right.
I've been thinking forward way too far. It's just something I do. And just thinking about
I think we've noticed, Chris.
Yeah, right. but thinking about, so working on one product now, so let's say there's a top level assembly ABC123, and then there's a sub assembly called DEF456, right?
Yep.
The idea is we could name everything ABC123-something to be the sub assembly, but then that thing could very realistically be reused in another product, right? And so then
it could.
And that's when it gets really, really confusing.
If you had
confusing.
An RF module or something,
for example. Say that you were going to do, the micro supply, right? You were going to have top level assembly ABC123, and then there's a secondary option thing. So there's a high power version where it's going to be ABC124.
Right, yes. And then you need two of those boards or something because it's high power, so it's double the power.
Sure, or it's a slightly modified version, or even just even there's just a color modification where the pegs are going to change or something like that, and it's that ripples through everything. And so I've been pushing for hey, let's do custom names for boards and stuff like that. I've been reading a bunch as well about other ways people do this. Sometimes it's literally everything's just a unique part number. It literally does not matter what it is. And that's how some companies do it, right? It starts at 000, and then the next thing is 001, and the next thing is 002. And 001 might be a screw, and 002 might be a fully assembled PCB, but you just do it incrementally.
We've had categories of parts. So we would have 123- and then 456, and that 456 would be a screw.
Yeah,
and then that'd be a category. So they separate into product and then category and then the individual part in that category. Yeah. So if you've got 10 screws, it'd be 123, 456, 001, 002, 003, and they'd be all screws. So you'd know that they're all screws.
But that's the other crazy thing about thinking too far forward, right? Is at a certain point, maybe not now, maybe not next year, maybe not in 10 years, but some companies that I've worked at have been around for 25 years. And they ran out of part numbers. It's holy crap.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a real thing that can happen. And it's who thinks you're going to run out of
if you work
five digits?
Like HP?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then,
well, that's the thing. Like, there's famous companies like HP that would have HP dash, and then they'd have three digits and then four digits or whatever. And they would get the manufacturers to silkscreen these onto the chips instead of, you know, it's a 74HC00, right? It's a regular 74HC00, but the manufacturer puts the HP part number silkscreened onto the chip.
Yeah.
So if you go to the HP website now, you can still access that database.
Yeah.
They have this database where you can look up this HP code and it tells you, oh, yeah, it's a 74HC00.
Yep, right.
You know, like,
and that's and
that is a thing.
But there's actually some purchasing, like, so this is like kind of merging like engineering into supply chain stuff too. And it's like there are some real reasons to do that too. Right. Like you could start to have like on a which one is it? Is it MRP or ERP? Whatever it is, you know, like you basically have a
ERP.
Yeah,
ERP.
Sure. Yes. Yeah, I think yeah. But basically, you know, okay, ABC123 is now the part number of that 74HC00, right? But you might buy it from, you know, you need 10 million of those parts per year. You might buy, as long as they're all spec'd and approved from different vendors, you might buy a bunch from TI and a bunch from NXP, whatever. And it doesn't matter because internally, the only thing you refer to is the ABC123. That's all you care about.
And I've done that at companies. And companies like HP will do that.
Sure.
You know, that HP part number referring to the 74HC00, there will be like five different manufacturers of that 74HC00, and it doesn't matter.
Right.
And you we know, should because you've done the qualification, and I've done these qualifications, these qualification reports that ensure that, you know, these three different manufacturers, they're all equivalent parts, and they get assigned the company part number.
Right, and we should say we should salute the component engineers out there, Dave. Don't you think we should?
Right,
we salute you. We know you're listening. We love you. You're amazing. It's a shitty job, and you do good work. Keep it up, folks.
And all those component obsolescence engineers
out
there.
Oh.
We salute you.
Dave. I remember Dave. He was
that's a real title.
Yeah. Oh, no. He's good people that I worked with. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, they were component obsolescence engineers.
Yep.
Yeah. And this company gets big enough. And, yeah, so then the buyers, like where you would have a team of buyers and they know nothing about electronics and stuff like that, but they buy these parts and they know that that part they can buy from these five different manufacturers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's all because it's all in the system and then they're all linked and approved and whatnot.
Right, because at the end of, and then they're able to go and do the buyer thing, which is, you know, again, we should give a little bit of props. Uh-huh. One of my best friends is a buyer.
Yep.
But like they go and they shout at the manufacturers and they say, you need to give us a 10% price reduction. And that actually can have some like long ripple effects there too.
Oh, yeah. So absolutely.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. So I'm just kind of trying to figure out like what is the best practice for naming these things? You know, do you give each assembly
a
unique name? Do you just start pulling numbers? You know, like
there's pros and cons. Like I wouldn't even want to try and hazard a guess at a best in quote marks way to do it.
I will. I may have also shared this story once before, but at my first co-op, for some reason, they let the co-op engineers pull numbers. There was an internal system.
Right.
It was just a data. It was like over top of a Microsoft Access database or something like that. And you know, you pressed a button and it pulled the next number. So it was like 18,557, and then you pressed a button and it said 18,558, and that was the number you pulled, and it was no big deal. However, one of the interns typed in 28557 and jumped 10,000 part numbers in one at once. And and that lives forever. You don't go back. You can't go back.
So
now there's just this gap.
Yeah, yeah.
And for all time, for as long as the company exists now, they're going to be like, what happened here? It's like, friggin' Mark.
exactly.
Oh man.
We had a convoluted part number system at Altium of all places, you know, because
I believe it.
Like internal because our hardware group, obviously, we had to have, you know, these approved parts that would like because then they would have a designated footprint and they'd have a designated schematic symbol, you know, and all that sort of stuff. So it ties into the design level like that as well. It's not just the assembly side of things. And it was convoluted and it kind of worked, but it was kind of sort of annoying at the same time. And
I mean, that's the thing, like all of these systems, they're always annoying, but damn, are they important. You know, like I just remember like we were like right at Keithley, I think it was, we were right on the edge of like using a new system. It was all web-based, but it shouldn't have been yet. You know, it should have been a local database, but they're trying really hard to make it web-based. And it was just like you would lose work all the time and it would just... it was a hot mess, you know, but but like this is where like information systems are really, really critical, you know.
And one of the problems was that, especially at the PCB stage, like you would go searching. Okay, so you're designing this new board, right? Which we did tons of. And you're looking, so you go searching for the part. You're about to put your schematic symbol down, which is then tied to your footprint and everything else. Sure. So you need something like a 10K resistor, right? Yeah, something simple like a 10K resistor. Oh, there's got to be one in the system. Of course there is, but it's a... And it's the footprint, it's the size you want. So it's an 0603 10K resistor, right? But of course, you know from the standards, the PCB footprint standards, there are three different sizes. There's large, medium, and small, or whatever it is, right? There's the three different variations in the official IPC standards.
Got it.
For that.
Yep.
So you may have used a normal one, right? The part in the system's normal, but then you're doing this ultra compact board where you've got to do all these small size footprints, the ones with a smaller fillet on it. So you'd have to create a new damn part, another 10K resistor, and with a slight variation on the footprint, even though the schematic symbols, and it'd just go on and on and on.
Oh my god!
And you'd end up with 20 10K resistors in the system.
Right, and then you grab the wrong one sometimes. Right,
and then you grab the wrong one, or you spend half the day just like looking at all the different parts because they weren't labeled. Mm-hmm. Properly, or you'd have to go in and double check just to make sure the previous person who did it didn't goof, and it's like, oh, you just spend forever.
Yeah. The argument against, I think the argument against atomic libraries like this, but at a certain point, like when it comes to like tying into actual like manufacturing systems, it's almost necessary, right? Because it's like, when you put down a part,
it's a necessary,
you want to know that it is the actual physical part.
It is solid.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
And you've used it before it worked and you're guaranteed it's going to work again. Yes.
And then when you were doing that, did you guys have a dedicated librarian to do that kind of thing as well? Or were you doing the actual generation?
We had dedicated librarians in Tasmania, insert Tasmanian jokes here, and who would do like footprints and stuff.
Sure.
They would do stuff for us. But we had to tie together at the higher level.
Yeah. So and that's what's crazy about it.
They would do the footprints. Yeah.
And that's, we would have to people tie haven't done that before. It's like, Dave's example, he needs a new 10K resistor now. It's like, okay, so you have to submit a request now. Here it has all the same part specs. Here's an example data sheet. Here's an approved part, an actual part number that's for it. And then you also have to say like, oh, I want it to be this specific type of tighter footprint. Please go and make this and attach it to this thing and tie it all the way back to their database. At the end of the day, it's like 4 hours later. It's crazy.
I know. And people might think, well, how can you get so many variants on a 10K resistor? Well, let me tell you how, okay? Not only is it it's a 10K resistor. That's fine. You might have a different schematic versions. You might have a larger one and then a more compact version.
Right, it depends on the squiggly line versus square box.
Squiggly lines versus the box, right? So there's two variants. And then it goes down like a tree. And then each one of those variants can have, okay, is it a 1% resistor? Is it a 0.5%?
Yep.
Is it a 0.1%?
Yep.
Okay. And then the tree down on that. Oh, is it 50 ppm? Is it 15 ppm?
Yep.
Is it 10 ppm?
Oh, man.
Right? And then the variation down on that, you can see this tree just growing. And then the variation down on that is, as I said, the footprint. Is it small, medium, or large, or some other weird-ass custom thing?
Right. And then if you know, like from the beginning, if you're like, oh, I need an R96 resistor, it's like, well, I'm definitely putting in a part request, because the chance that you have a resistor at this weird ass value that you chose, and all the specs that you need, is like, there's no chance. You just start.
And it was never there. Yeah. The part Murphy would ensure the part you wanted was never there, even though it was a 10K resistor.
I was going to say, Murphy would say that there'd be one just about there.
it's almost there, but you had to then take out another part number to create a variant because you wanted 10 ppm instead of 15.
That's right, yep.
You know, like, oh my god, like, yeah.
Yep.
Seriously, people think, oh, this modular design or whatever you want to call it, you know, is just, you know, these global, why isn't there one library out there that the entire internet, there's whole companies based around this. Yeah, I got an email from one the other day who's, oh, we've solved the component problem. You know, look, the whole community has come together and verify that this component's good. And it's like, dude, no, like you don't understand the complexity. Right. Everyone needs something slightly different.
Right.
And that is the fundamental problem, and it always will be.
Yeah, I think. And I mean, I think that's why there's a business magic for like the Snap EDAs and the, you know, the ultra librarians of the world, like the Upverter has that now too. The EE, oh, I forget what they call their product, but basically, like all of these like on-demand part generation services is because it's solving. Mm. It's basically solving this problem that we're talking about, where it's now, you know, hired out to someone else, you know, pay the fee or whatever it is, and they just do it. You know, that's their business model effectively. No, nothing's solved. Yep. It's just everything's custom and a little bit faster.
and again, there's no best way to do it.
Yeah,
Do you create the 20 different variants of that 10K resistor, or do you have just one or two, and then on your PCB, once you've and then tweak it on your PCB? Oh, I need a small footprint instead of the large one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, kind of. Do you do that, or do you go back and do it at the schematic?
Right.
You know, a component level with its own individual part number. There's no
right
or wrong there.
Yeah, I do the latter.
Like, there's nothing wrong with tweaking on the PCB.
Yeah, that's what I do. But you then know? It's like, that is only for small companies, I think. Right? It's like, because then I'm going out, I'm buying parts from a distributor like a Mouser or DigiKey or whatever.
Yeah, I think the bigger you get, the more inevitable it is that you
if you're buying by the wheel, or if you talk to a supply chain expert, if you have a supply chain expert in your company, there is very little chance that you get to tweak it on the PCB, I think.
Oh, yeah. They won't tolerate that. Yeah, exactly.
I have...
Oh, it's a can of worms.
I have one other question about revision, or sorry, part numbers, since we're on this enthralling topic.
Yes.
How do you do revisions on your board? So I was asking about this on the consulting forum as well. I'll give you an example of what I do, and maybe just use that as the basis. There's how long is this piece of string, as you like to say, right?
Yeah.
But this is what I've been doing, is like x.y.z, and then this is the one I propose, at least. It's like major, minor, and then firmware revision, where you leave a blank for the firmware revision, because it's probably going to be a sticker or, you know, put under the board, because that's going to change the most often. But major would be like PCB revision, Y would be like modifications to population options, and then Z would be like firmware revisions. You know, and like I said, stickers are probably going to be stuck on the board in order to modify that thing.
I would never go to the firmware level.
Yeah.
I'd never go to the firmware. That would always be done as a sticker. That would never be populated as part of the part number or part of the revision for the PCB.
No. Nothing. So like when I say it's on the PCB, I would say like it would almost be like on the, so if it was like version 3 of the PCB itself, it'd be 3 dot blank dot blank on the PCB, because then you'd fill in like, you know, what revision is, because you're not going to rev the PCB each time. You're going to rev the PCB once, and then you might have population options, and then you have firmware options. But I'm saying, now when I write you an email and I say, hey Dave, 3.1.2, which is, you know, PCB 3 version 3, assembly version 1, firmware version 2 is borked, as it is inevitably to be. I'm saying, like, you need like this, like the
You're tying together PCB revisions with assemblies.
Yeah,
that's a different beast. You're talking about a top level part number of a multi, you know, of a product that has multiple variations, like you talked about right at the start of all this. Whereas if you're talking about just revision of a PCB, so are you talking about revisions of assemblies?
Then, this would be the entire thing.
Okay, in terms of the micro supply,
sure,
right? Okay, you'd have the PCB part number, then you'd have the assembly tacked onto that. It'd be XXX-YYYY, and then dash, you know, and then rev one. So the rev two of the micro supply might have a blue banana jack instead of a red
one. Sure. Yep.
For example, is that what you're talking about?
Yeah. If you're saying that's a okay, let's go back to the
because it could be a different orderable product for different market segments, right? In Europe, they want blue banana plugs, right?
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, that might be.
Whereas the US market want red banana plugs.
Yeah.
This, seriously.
Yeah, like, yeah, yeah. This no, is I totally believe that, actually.
Yeah.
No, this was actually more talking. This was kind of a separate discussion than. So this is now just thinking of the PCB, the assembled PCB with firmware on it as an assembly, right? It's in the overall right. case.
Okay, so you're talking about just the PCB. Yeah. Forget the case,
so
everything else.
I basically right. order something from an assembly house, right? I say, hey, yep. I want to order from you, you know, version 3.1 is effectively what they would know. Maybe I say 3.1.12. This is the example I've been using. 3.1.12, right? That would be version 3 of the PCB, right? That would be the third time I've revved mm-hmm. the actual, FR4. Mm. Version 1 of the actual assembly of that FR4, right? And then pre-programmed or programmed firmware 12 when I order it.
What, yeah.
Is this too complicated? Like, so then the question is, how do you do it? Do you just say, oh, it's Rev A, Rev B, Rev C? Is that how you do it?
Yeah, on the boards. Yeah, we would separate boards from assembly. Like, it's, yeah.
Okay. I mean, that's this is always. Why I'm asking.
And then there's this discussion of, well, what should you rev? What dictates revising a PCB? If you just, you know, do a few tidy ups on the traces, especially internal revisions. Okay, it's not just external, it's internal revisions. Mm. How do you do your internal stuff? Like you've finished your board and then you might decide, oh, no, I just want to tweak a few things. Are you going to increase the revision of the board even though you haven't released it
yet? Yeah.
A lot of companies will say yes,
sure.
You must, right?
Yeah, because I think there's a psychological thing of like, oh, well, I don't want this to be like a major new revision. It's not a 4.0.
Exactly, I was just on 3.0. No, I just moved a few traces
exactly,
over here.
Right.
And, you know, like,
but,
yeah.
But I actually saw that right. taken to an even more extreme example. I was reading some mechanical stuff. I think it was GrabCAD or someone, one of the online like mechanical companies had an ebook about this. And they're like, if anything changes, you pull a completely new part number. And you mark it as such.
Right.
Now, they're talking mechanical yep. stuff where it's like, it is, yep. you know, you change the chamfer on something and it's like, no, that's a new part now. But I kind of like that idea. It's just a nightmare from a, you know,
it's fine
stuff
in theory.
Up,
yeah.
yeah, keeping stuff up to yeah. date. And like, and that's, I think, one of the problems is like, if you're just as a computer is like, yeah, it's a unique identifier. I don't care what you call it. But if it's a human, you're like, oh, this switched from a 3.0 to a 4.0. What did you do? You know?
Yeah, I know. Exactly.
Yeah, so it's like, yep. yeah, well.
yeah. Yep.
So, nah, yeah, I've had some good responses about it and some good discussions about it. But, like, generally, I'm just, you know, curious about resources on this stuff, too, because I'm sure it's out there. I just haven't found it. I don't know if I'm searching for the wrong things. And it's all opinion, too, so it's... It's basically just trying to glue together
opinions.
Oh, everyone
will think their system's the best, and everyone right. will give you 10 reasons why their system's the best.
I actually think right. everyone's is the worst, including my own. This is the problem. Right. You know, like, you've dealt yeah. with it. I've dealt with it, right? It's always, like, it's usually yeah. legacy, and now that I'm, like, working with startups
yeah, yeah.
and, you know, younger companies, it's like, I want
to
put
you
something
get
decent.
To introduce it from scratch.
Yeah, I just
want to
put something decent in place. It doesn't be perfect, but just something decent.
Yeah.
And so that's why I'm asking these questions of, like, yeah, what's like a best practice at least? You know, if there was like a general guideline, I'd be like, yeah, that's fine. I'll just do that.
I don't think it matters as long as you're consistent.
I agree with that.
I really don't.
Yeah.
It's, as long as you're consistent, and then all new employees that come to the company, they learn that, you know, yeah. system, and they become consistent with it, and it's fine.
Yep. Yep.
So yeah.
Yeah. Well, lots to learn, I suppose.
Yep. At the like for startups, you see, I would be against introducing too much of a rigid system like that. It really stifles the
too much process. You're saying,
you know, the lean sort of, you know, startup, you know, ethos. It's like it goes against all that.
Sure.
It's
sure.
like, you know, because you want to churn out prototypes quick. You want to, you know, you just like everything's forgotten about last week. You know, who cares what we did last week? We're just going forward.
No,
you know,
I get that. But like right when you start interacting with a contract manufacturer, that's when it's like, no, this is real.
Yeah.
And it's like,
true.
Because the thing that I worry about is like talking to someone. And that's why I was saying like 3.1.2. If I talk to someone, it should be enough of an address effectively so that it's unique enough
yeah.
that they're like, right. oh, I know what that is. And I say, I know yeah. what that is. And we talk about that together. If I just say it's like, oh, yeah. well, it's Rev 3 and, you know, we built a couple of these boards and it's, you know, we put the latest firmware on.
Yeah.
It's like, what the hell does that mean? You know, that doesn't,
yeah, right.
you know, like having like something where
it's all warm and fuzzy.
It's an
yeah.
actual unique identifier that says something useful
right.
is what I'm really trying to get
yeah.
at. So I'd love to hear from people if they have, best practices on that stuff.
Yeah. Depends on your anal retentiveness
that's right.
level.
Yeah, yeah.
Yep.
We are running out of time, but I wanted to mention...
We're out of time.
Yeah, we are out of time. I'm going to be at Teardown in Portland. That is at the end of June. That is a conference for run mm-hmm. by CrowdSupply. And I'll be giving a talk there about... what did I call it? 5 minutes of...
Hang on. Let me guess. KiCad.
Nope. 5 minutes of video in a 10-pound bag or something like that. It was like basically like how to record videos really fast. You know, about KiCad.
right. Yeah, of course. Yeah. Using the example, yeah.
Speaking of KiCad videos, almost all the KiCad videos are now up on the Contextual Electronics channel.
Excellent.
I'll link those as well. There were some really good ones. So
how many of them are now obsolete? Because somebody's changed something.
I think these are, you know, probably 10%.
Right. 10% are obsolete or only 10% are relevant?
No, I was going to say obsolete. I don't think they're actually obsolete, but that was, yeah. Right. There might be some stuff there. Right. I also wanted to announce I got a ticket for Chaos Communication Camp, which is in Berlin in August 21st to 25th. So German listeners, if you're going to be there, I'd love to meet up. I'd love to see more of Germany. I love Berlin as well. So if you're going to be there, let me know. And
I have not been to Berlin.
Well, you want to go, Dave? Come on. It's only, 40? Sure. 40 hours of travel to go sleep in a tent?
50?
Yeah.
No, 60, okay. Actually. Yeah. 60. Yeah. 60 hours.
Okay.
Yep, to get to Berlin.
Yeah.
Yeah, the there and back. Yep,
yeah,
60.
Worth it, man. Come on.
Yeah, totally.
A bunch of nerds hanging out in the field. It's good. It's good stuff.
Right.
Not showering for 5 days. It's gonna be something else.
Right. Utopia. Yeah. It's gonna be the Woodstock of the nerd generation.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah, and then one more. I'll also be at SuperCon in November. So that is the last thing. Those are. And Black Hat. So those are like the rest of my conferences for the. I'm done with conferences.
I thought you were giving up the conference thing. I thought you were settling down.
I mean,
giving up the whole.
Get out for some things, you know.
Right. Okay. Right.
Yeah. Now the difference is I pay for my own travel, Dave.
Bummer.
Yeah. It's good. I got shorter US or XLR cables. So I'll be recording too. So Amp Hour listeners will benefit.
Excellent.
Yes. Cool. All right. Well, good luck with the yet to be seen MicroSupply. I'm sure people will be excited
to
see that.
Thank you very much. Oh, you might be interested. One last thing. You might be interested to know that we've decided to actually get a contract manufacturer to assemble four for us. It's
great.
We couldn't be asked to assemble them ourselves. Like we just want four of these boards. We just couldn't be asked to do it.
It's probably a good test run for actually assemble too.
Yeah, it's a reasonable test run, and there's lots of fiddly little
right. They'll be able to give you feedback that another CM would like a higher volume CM would be getting too. So that's a good test run. You should go and sit there probably while they do it, or get video of them. Yeah. Ask them to do video while they do it.
Oh, and the thing is, they'll source all the parts too.
Ooh, that's nice. So it's like a box build.
Yeah, they'll source it.
Oh, that's great.
We just give them the bomb and they will source they'll source everything, assemble them, and deliver us four assembled boards.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's great.
You know that, and you know how many hours that saves us?
Yeah, that's almost always worth it. I've been coming around to that finally.
Yep. And like, whereas one, you know, before we've been assembling one, it's like, you know, it's for prototype testing, it's like, well, we can't go and get them to assemble one.
Right.
You know, head down, bum up, do it ourselves. But four, it's like, you know, because we want a few of these, four, maybe five of them. And it's like, yeah, let's just pay I think it's $1,200 or something.
Yep.
To get five of them, which, you know, it might sound...
It's like six hours of time.
You know, but exactly. How much, you know, you would spend a lot more hours than that doing it. And that'd be expensive if it was just assembly, but it's not. It's sourcing and we've got a lot of parts on this thing. There's a lot of individual parts. It's a big bomb. You'd be stunned at the number of bomb items on a little tiny handheld power supply thing. Mm-hmm. And they'll just take care of all that hassle for us. And it's like, that's a complete no-brainer. We'll do that.
And awesome.
Yep.
Well, I'm looking forward to getting my first unit. You know, I'm sure I'm going to be on the list of the first four in.
Oh, Oh, maybe. I don't know. I don't know what we're doing before. Yeah.
Like, don't send it to me. I'm not a good beta tester.
Do we get 10? We're still not 100. Like, if we were sure that, if we were like 80% confident that this was like the final thing and there were going to be no mods, then we'd probably get like 10 of them and ship a few to out to people. But it's like,
yeah.
I asked David the other day, and how confident? Oh, 20%. It's like,
that's a good hedge right there. That's a good hedge.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we'll just get 4 of them. Yeah. Thanks.
You can ship those out and have them sent back. I mean, that's still doable.
But anyway, yeah, we want a couple and then a few to totally abuse. Mm-hmm. You know, we want a couple just to use from a, you know, a firmware usability and testing point of view, and then you want a couple that you can have your way with. You know.
Yeah, that's great, man.
Anyway,
cool. We'll talk about that more next time.
Catch you next time.